We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. There are a few issues more controversial than the meaning of the Second Amendment. Now, I don't know when last time you might have looked at it is, but I'll read it to you. It's very short. It's one sentence. It goes like this. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's it. Now, gun rights advocates, they tend to focus on that part of the sentence that talks about the right of the people to keep and bear arms. They say what that means is that it's all about protecting an individual's right to have a gun for his personal purpose, whether that be sporting or self-defense. Those people who favor gun control say, well, really, this is about the right of states to organize civil defense forces, and they focus on the first part of the sentence, the well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. This morning, what we're going to try to do is get a little bit, see if we can get a little bit beyond this kind of pro-con formulation and ask this question. If we go back and we take a look at how the people who wrote this thought about it and what people were thinking about at the time, will that historical perspective help us and not only understand what was going on then, but perhaps what can we bring to the current debate about guns if we try to put this in its historical context? Our guest for the program is Saul Cornell. He's professor of history at Fordham University. He specializes in early American history and legal constitutional history, and he has done a lot of writing about and talking about the Second Amendment, among other things. He's the author of a book that came out a couple of years ago. The title of his book is A Well-Regulated Militia. The subtitle is The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press. I'm sure that you could find the book if you were interested in reading it. Questions are welcome, too, and we ask people, please be brief, so that way we can get in as many different people as possible, keep things moving along. But certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We also have email, so if you'd like to send along your comments that way, you can do that. And that's will-talk. WILL-talk at illinois.edu. At any point here, your questions certainly are welcome. Professor Cornell, hello.
Yes, well, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. And it seems to me that certainly the contemporary argument now about guns and societies seems very much to be framed in this particular way. That is, it's about individual rights versus collective rights. And you make the argument that I think is very interesting, and it's a more subtle kind of way of looking at this, because what you're saying is, well, actually, that's neither side is really right. And the way that you put it is, it's not an individual right, it's not a collective right, it is an individual right exercised collectively. Now, let's unpack that a little bit. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, the way you framed it in the introduction, I think, was very, very lucid and very, very helpful. In modern America, we have a gun control position and a gun rights position. And as you very eloquently put it, for gun rights, the message is very simple. It's about individual rights. For gun control people, it has generally been about the right of states to maintain well-regulated militias. Now, when I started looking into this history, I had one of those experiences that I think historians often have, which is when you actually start unpacking what was happening at the time, you realize that our modern categories just don't work, that trying to fit it into a gun control, gun rights dichotomy simply obscures more than it clarifies. Because fundamentally, in the 18th century, what you had were people who believed that we needed an armed population, but also believed that armed population had to be organized and well-regulated by law that, you know, you simply couldn't have people acting unilaterally because then you'd have an armed mob, not a well-regulated militia. So that in the contemporary debate, if you're gun control, you're probably not very pro-gun. And if you're gun rights, you're probably pretty militantly anti-regulation. But the Founding Fathers were actually pro-regulation and pro-gun, and that is the position that has disappeared from our public discourse. And given that guns are an important part of American culture, and given that there are a lot of guns, that seems to me that that particular position is the only one that makes sense in contemporary America. And it was, ironically, the one that the founders actually adhered to. Mm-hmm. It's the one that is missing from our current debate over guns.
What does strike me, though, is that it seems like while we think of this as being a very contemporary argument, that people going back to even the point before the Constitution was written, we're having this argument. And I was, in fact, really struck by the idea that this idea that sometimes now people advance, that if you prevent honest citizens from having guns, that will mean only criminals will have them. That is a very old idea.
Yes, that is an idea that was perhaps first our first evidence that anyone framed it in those terms was the Enlightenment Italian theorist Beccaria, who was writing about crime and punishment. And it is an old idea, and I think that the big problem we have in the modern debate is that there isn't much of a sense of this as a sort of unfolding history. People sort of tend to take the position that they hold now and assume that it's always been there and that it's always been there in exactly the same form. I mean, all these ideas have roots in our history, but I think when you look at the history, what you see is it's a bit of a roller coaster ride. It's not just a kind of simple linear progression from then to now. It really has a lot of interesting twists and turns.
You talked about the fact that back at the time that we're talking about, before the U.S. Constitution was written, that people at this time in America certainly recognized the need for common defense. But as you point out in the book, they were also very concerned about the idea of a standing peacetime army. They didn't like that. They saw that as a threat. So what they came up with, or what developed, was this idea of a citizen's army, essentially. But this was not although I think one should be careful about how we talk about this, because this was not something in which everyone was included.
Well, that's right. I mean, we, of course, live in a society that is characterized by democratic values. The founders recognized that a certain dose of democracy was essential, but they were not small-D Democrats. They were small-R Republicans. And one of the strange, another irony about the way the modern debate often plays itself out is we often forget that in the 18th century, rights sometimes carried obligations. And the right to bear arms was actually tied to an obligation to participate in the militia and submit to military regulation. So in a way, what you have going on in the 18th century is the first unfunded mandate. You know, we oftentimes hear about in Obama's health care that, you know, people are being asked to buy something, whether then that's actually true or not. The fact is the founders were perfectly willing to have people buy something, and what they demanded that people buy were muskets so that they could participate in the militia.
And I guess that's interesting that, in fact, one might say, well, if the government was really concerned about having this militia and having people armed, maybe what the government should have done was buy the guns and hand them out. Well, the fact was that the government, they really didn't have the money. And so what this was, their way of dealing with it was to saying to people, all right, you have to go out and supply your own.
Right, it's a form of taxation. I mean, if you point that out to people who are sort of militantly in the gun rights camp, they sort of look at you quizzically. But the reality is that you were being forced to fund the cost of public defense by buying your own firearm and making your own ammunition. And it was a way of transferring the burden of public defense to individual households. So it's a form of taxation at one level.
And yet again, though, this did not apply to everyone. What we're talking about here was this was something that was a right and a responsibility that applied to white men. Native Americans, black people, women, they were not part of this.
Right, and even more astonishing, you know, because we sometimes talk about the Second Amendment as being a part of right of revolution. That's one sort of popular gun rights formulation. You know, it's the final check on government tyranny. But, of course, the founders were a little bit nervous about that. Although they themselves were a particularly sober kind of revolutionary, they were not at all averse to the idea of disarming people who refused to swear loyalty to the new American states and then later to the United States Constitution. So, in fact, to exercise this right of bearing arms, you had to actually forswear the right of revolution, which, of course, is another really interesting historical fact that oftentimes is omitted in the modern debate.
And as I understand you, what we're talking about here is we're talking about state laws. That is, in each state, this maybe was looked at a little bit differently. Was there, in fact, a lot of difference in the way that the militia was organized or in the way that the state government thought about that responsibility and what went with it? Was there a lot of difference from one state to another?
Well, the first thing to point out is we're used to a fairly large national centralized government. Of course, in the 18th century, you had a very weak centralized government. The vast majority of all laws were actually state laws, and certainly the vast majority of laws dealing with things like firearms would have been local laws, laws about, you know, storing them safely, laws about how you had to handle gunpowder. So the first reality that's different is that most lawmaking about firearms is going to be done at the state level. In terms of the idea of the militia, I would say what's interesting is if you look across states, most of the militia laws from the states are pretty similar in their structure. They sort of define who's in the militia. They define what you need and what to report to muster, and what the penalties are if you fail to do that. I mean, that's another thing that's often forgotten is that you could be fined for failing to report to a muster. You know, we have this very sort of libertarian government off our backs kind of view of firearms. That's the sort of modern gun rights culture. But of course, basically what these laws were doing was saying, look, you know, if you don't report to muster, you violated the law and you will be fined or jailed. So, again, our idea that it's sort of almost anti-government provision buried in our constitutions, which is itself a kind of funny idea, it turns out not to be the case. It's a very different conception of the relationship between citizens and their government, because, of course, the notion was that citizens were tied to their government through these sort of local communities where the militia was a basic institution. And it's part of a sort of, you know, chain that ties people to their government. And in many respects, that chain has been broken because we don't have those local institutions functioning quite the way they did in the 18th century. You know, we don't have, despite these militia groups propping up, we really don't have a Minuteman culture at the moment.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Saul Cornell. He's professor of history at Fordham University. His area of interest is early American history and legal constitutional history, and he's done a lot of writing and speaking on the subject of the Second Amendment, and is, in fact, the author of the book titled A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press, and a lot of the book is devoted to the thinking about this particular issue in early America, particularly in the run-up to the writing of the U.S. Constitution. Questions welcome. Again, you can help us by keeping them brief, but people are welcome into the conversation, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. Someone out in Iowa, Clinton, Iowa, is up here first, line four. Hello. Yes, hello. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to ask your guest if he'd respond to the notion that my understanding of militias would be our National Guard would be equivalent now to what a militia was then. But one of the big differences, I believe, would be that when we get done with weekend training or two-week service, we leave the M16s back at the armory. And it's my impression that during the early days, when they had the militias, they took the weapons home with them. And so that would imply to me that the people who wrote this did intend for the guns to be kept at a government place. They intended for all these people to take these weapons home, and they would have them in their homes. Could you address that distinction, please?
Sure. I mean, the first thing to point out is that we have had a lot of history between the era of the Minutemen and the era of the modern National Guard, and Americans have made a series of choices through their elected representatives to change the nature of the militia. We could easily, if we wanted to bear that responsibility and that burden, we could all lobby to have the 18th century militia recreated, but that would mean that, you know, at a minute's notice, you have to drop everything that you're doing and muster. So, I mean, again, that's a significant burden that the citizenry would have to want to take on, but, you know, it's in our power to do that anytime we want to. As far as, you know, guns stored in armories versus guns stored at home, I mean, that's a practical decision. The founders didn't write into the Constitution any requirement where guns needed to be stored, or in fact, you know, it actually doesn't even say guns in the Constitution. It says bear arms. You know, who knows in 100 years whether we'll be talking about guns or some, you know, sort of analogous type of weaponry. So fundamentally, the question of where those guns need to be stored in order to make the militia most effective is a policy decision that gets made by Congress, because the Constitution is very clear about Congress having the ultimate authority about the laws that govern the militia. So it was practical in the 18th century, particularly in a lot of communities where you had frontier situations, and of course one of the real threats was the rather hostile relationship between various Native American populations and the frontiersmen who were pushing westward and encroaching on their lands. So in that situation, obviously, there's real utility to having guns in people's homes. You know, in certain urban areas, at various moments in American history, you know, having the guns stored centrally might have been more effective. And we've seen different solutions to different problems at different times.
Colin, does that get at your question?
Yes, thank you.
All right, let's go to then somebody else here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. In reference to, like, a storage of arms, you have Harper's Ferry prior to the Civil War and John Brown, and you had government contracts to Colt and things like that, where the government would buy rifles and store them, obviously, somewhere, and I assume that they would just draft people or call up a local militia or raise an army, to use that term. But I was going to go back to, I want to reverse what you said earlier about what would weapons be in the future. The term arm in the 18th century was actually sidearms, side swords, bayonets, and, like bowie knives and stuff. And people were carried those around, and they're illegal now. You cannot wear a side sword, and you cannot carry a blade, usually most states, longer than 4 inches. So to use that term, I mean, if you could outlaw, like, swords and stuff, so what's the difference between outlawing certain kinds of weapons, you know, guns? And I think it has a lot to do with the vicarious nature of a pistol and a rifle, and that you can shoot somebody from distance. It's real difficult to kill somebody up close, so with a knife.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that for a large chunk of time, edged weapons, which were part of the sort of standard equipment issue of an 18th century militiaman, particularly a bayonet. I mean, to have a properly functional weapon, it had to be able to mount a bayonet because of the nature of 18th century military tactics, where after, a round of fire, you know, there you are pretty close in. If you don't have that bayonet, you're in pretty serious trouble. And of course, until the technology of handguns gets a lot better, we have all kinds of evidence about how much more reliable, edged weapons are than handguns until at least the middle of the 19th century. So, and in fact, it explains in part why you see very little reference to actually pistols in militia statutes, with the exception of horsemen's pistols, which are what Dragoon, precursor of cavalry units. They're really the only group that has a requirement for some kind of pistol. Virtually everyone else is required to own a musket of some kind. And that, I think, reflects the nature of 18th century military tactics. You aren't seeing a lot of pistols. Obviously you have dueling pistols, and gentlemen would have braces of pistols and things like that. But the culture of 18th century America was predominantly a long gun culture, not a handgun culture. That's another really interesting difference between contemporary America, which is really a handgun culture, and the founders, who were much more interested in in long guns because of their military utility.
Well, but what I'm getting at is that the legal argument, the originalists, the people who say the writers of the Constitution meant X, saying that arms cannot be abridged, you know, not pistols, rifles, whatever. So arms are inclusive of those terms. So if all these originalists are running around saying, oh, you can't take my gun away because X, they're actually it's not a complete argument. Because the last thing in the world they'd ever want to do is walk around, you know, like the mall with every third person carrying a sword. So it's just silly. Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, something that I'd like to get at here, I think that for people who, tend to focus on the right to have the weapon, they seem very much concerned about the issue of defense, about self-defense.
Right.
And in a sense, in two ways. One, I think they're concerned about self-defense on a personal, individual basis, defending yourself from some other individual who might want to hurt you. But then in a larger sense, there's this concern about the need to defend yourself against government. If we look at the first case, what did people at the time recognize the right of an individual to use a weapon in self-defense against another person, and sort of in the way that we think about it? And in fact, did they think that the Second Amendment had really anything to say about that?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think in modern America, like is often the case, we tend to get the history backwards. So the gun rights view of individual self-defense is, because having a gun for self-defense is useful for a militia, that's why we have the right. In fact, the founders tended to view it the other way. Because you needed a well-regulated militia, you had a right to have a firearm. And like any legally possessed piece of property, you could use that firearm the way you could use a hatchet, the way you could use a 2x4, in legal self-defense. And in fact, there are a couple of efforts to protect something like a modern right of self-defense in the 18th century, and they're almost always defeated because they're viewed generally not because the founders are against self-defense, but because the belief is that the common law clearly protects a right of self-defense. It's actually a much more narrow right of self-defense than the one we enjoy today, because in fact your duty is to retreat to the wall before responding with deadly force, so you don't have this sort of expansive castle doctrine the way we have today, where anyone who gets in your castle, metaphorically, you're allowed to respond with deadly force. So the founders recognized the right of self-defense. It was more narrowly constrained than the one we have today, and it really was in the 18th century quite distinct from the right to bear arms in a well-regulated militia. But in the 19th century, there does start to be some blending of those two concepts, and that's really where our sort of modern confusion stems from. Virtually all of our problems about guns and gun rights and gun control have very little to do with the 18th century and the founders and the Second Amendment. They're all a function of what happened about 30 to 40 years later, when you see the first pistols being produced in large number, and then you see the first effort to really severely curtail and restrict those weapons because of the danger they pose to society. And so our modern problem really is a creation of the 19th century and has very little to do with the 18th century.
All right. Let's talk with someone here, someone else, someone in Champaign this time, line number two. Hello.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I have two questions. One of them is, can you shed any light on how the Supreme Court finds its way to making decisions about state or local laws, since the Constitution says Congress shall make no law abridging, the right to own and bear arms? And then the other one is, how do the gun rights folks explain or understand the well-regulated militia part of that statement in the Constitution? I'll hang up and take your comments. Thanks.
Sure. Two excellent questions. Well, the original Bill of Rights, of course, are restrictions on the federal government, not the states. Because of the 14th Amendment, however, certain aspects of the Bill of Rights have been applied to the states through a legal doctrine known as incorporation. And in fact, we have a case that will be decided this spring that came before the Supreme Court about whether or not the Second Amendment ought to be incorporated. And the long question is a Chicago law that makes it illegal to have a handgun, although you can still have long guns. So the question of the application of these rights, in this case the Second Amendment to the states, is currently before the court. And I think most people are of the opinion the court is likely to incorporate it, which is to say likely to apply it to the states. And then, you know, as far as what the well-regulated militia part of the Second Amendment, you know, the old NRA headquarters used to have written in stone, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They just sort of, you know, sort of air blasted out the first part of the Second Amendment. If you ask gun rights people, that, you know, they'll go through some very interesting and I think ultimately somewhat amateurish kinds of historical exercises where they'll say, well, if you look up the Oxford Unabridged Dictionary, one of the 50 meanings of well-regulated is disciplined, so therefore what they're talking about is not to be brought under legal control, but they're simply talking about being disciplined. It turns out the new Articles of Confederation, when they talk about the militia, they talk about it being well-regulated and disciplined, so that argument doesn't strike me as being very persuasive. But, you know, there's a lot of people spend a lot of time on this issue, a lot of amateur historians, a lot of legal scholars, some of whom are amateur historians. And so the result is we have a huge paper trail and an even larger sort of internet trail of a whole host of arguments. Most of them, I don't think, are very persuasive. But they're certainly pervasive, if not persuasive. Hmm.
Well, to continue with that, maybe you could talk a little bit more. We've touched on the idea that at the time, people were, on the one hand, they were very concerned about this idea of having a standing peacetime army. They were concerned about that, but that also among the founders, there really was this serious concern about the possibility of an armed mob. That I think contributed in the minds of some to the idea that you really needed to have more of a central government authority, and that possession and use of guns had to be regulated. And the idea was that, yes, people were going to have this gun and that they were going to participate in this militia, but that it had to be something that was regulated and under the authority of the government. Before the Constitution was written, we had some things that really focused people's attention on this. And I guess the one thing I'm thinking about here is Shay's Rebellion.
Yes.
Which is something that you write about in the book. And you say this was very important for a lot of the framers as they thought about this right and thought about what ultimately would become the Second Amendment. Talk about that.
Well, yes. Again, the modern gun rights, as you've described, is really divided in really – there are two main issues that define modern gun rights culture. One is this concern about individual self-defense. And the other, of course, is this longstanding fear of centralized government that has very deep roots in American history. And many people in the gun rights community, and certainly people in the militia movement, would argue that the Second Amendment is there to make it possible for us to resist the federal government. Well, of course, we wouldn't actually have the federal government if a group of farmers in western Massachusetts hadn't had the same idea and decided to organize themselves as militia units outside of government authority and to take up arms against the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And, of course, the founders, with the exception of Jefferson, who's off in Paris drinking, you know, Chateau Margaux and writing letters back to James Madison saying, you know, don't sweat it, James, you know, life is good, which, of course, it was in Paris for Jefferson, that by and large most of the founding fathers are quite frightened by Shay's Rebellion. They see it as a very dangerous sign that America's very young experiment in Republican government may not survive. And they respond quite vigorously in terms of putting it down. Even Sam Adams, who is one of the most radical voices during the Revolution and who really does believe there is a right of revolution, essentially believes that once you have a constitution and once there are functioning courts and representative government, there simply is no right of revolution anymore, that the right of revolution only exists in a state of nature, and to enter a state of nature from civil society, you must either destroy all form of representation or destroy all form of the rule of law. So as long as we have the rule of law and we have representation, most of the founders believed, you know, the right of revolution simply ended with the adoption of the Constitution. There are now legal and constitutional mechanisms for change, so therefore the revolutionary mechanism is no longer an option.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get to in just a second. I do want to introduce again our guest, Saul Cornell. He's professor of history at Fordham University. His interest is early American history, legal constitutional history, He's done a lot of writing about the subject here we're talking about this morning, the Second Amendment. And if you're interested, by the way, in doing some reading on it, you can look for his book, A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. It is published by the Oxford University Press. We have another caller. We'd welcome others, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, that was exactly the point I was going to make about Shays. And if you want to look at the original intent of the founders, you have to understand that how desperately they're afraid they were of it, and that the Constitution. But this really opens up a whole different perspective on the Constitution as a sort of reaction to, you know, some rather simple demands from against the bankers and against the government. Shays was trying to get the money that they were promised for their Revolutionary War service, among other things. So this was the Constitution in this sense can be construed as a bit of a counter-revolution, it seems to me, and that's very heretical, and it doesn't get the light of day. I wonder how you handle the implications of that analysis, because it's not far from some strains in historical analysis. I think Charles Beard's economic analysis of the Constitution, or whatever it was called, it talks about that to some extent too, but it really flies in the face of the idea that the founders were still in any kind of revolutionary spirit when they were writing the Constitution. So, how do you handle that? And do you get attacked for being anti-American or something? Because you think the Constitution...
Well, I think that's an excellent question. You know, I sometimes joke with my students that if we'd had the scenario today, you know, we would have just had Willie Nelson do like a Farm Aid conference, and Shays would have gotten, you know, his moment in the glory, and we wouldn't have actually had the Constitution. We would have had like a benefit concert and a CD to take home. But unfortunately, there wasn't a Willie Nelson back then, and so you did have this uprising in Western Massachusetts. And I think it is true that although it's heretical to say that the Constitution is part of a counter-revolutionary movement, it is one of the oldest heresies in American history. And the invocation of Charles Beard, the great progressive historian who wrote the beginning of the 20th century, is appropriate. I think historians have had a difficult time, and they tend to sort of go back and forth about, was the Constitution the sort of fulfillment of the Revolution or the betrayal of the Revolution? And I think in a way the Constitution really is a neither a fulfillment or a betrayal, but the Constitution is a effort to move beyond the Revolution and create a different style of politics. And you know, revolutions are particular moments, and people who have revolutionary experiences, nations that have revolutionary experiences, often find that the Che Guevara's are very useful up until the Revolution, but not so useful after the Revolution. I mean, same is true in America in a way. Sam Adams is exactly the kind of guy you need in the Revolution. But once you have the Revolution, the guy you really need is James Madison. So I think I totally accept the idea that the Constitution puts America on a very different trajectory than the Revolution had put the country on, and there are both gains and losses as a result of that.
Well, it was written in secret by some of the richest people and the most landed in the time, and John Jay said, of course, the people that should run the country are the people that own it. So, I mean, I think...
It's good that some things never change, right?
Jour le même chose. I would open the eyes of this analysis would open the eyes, but it doesn't really get much traction, despite the fact you say that Beard is there and other people. It's a history. I forgot how you exactly expressed it, but.
Well, I do think we do still teach the Beard thesis, and I think that one of the reasons it's so exciting to teach the American Revolution to students year in and year out is because, and this period of Constitution making is, each generation approaches the topic somewhat differently. And I think even regionally, you know, I oftentimes ask my students to respond to a series of statements that were made during the debate over the Constitution. And I have found that over the years, and, you know, I taught at William & Mary, and I taught at Ohio State in the Midwest. So my students at William & Mary and at Ohio State were largely anti-federalist in their sympathies, not federalist. Now that I'm teaching in New York, not surprisingly, I did the same exercise with my students at Fordham, and they turned out to be very federalist, which seems appropriate because I'm now in Hamilton country. I'm not in, in sort of a Jeffersonian part of the country. I'm in a part of the country where probably Alexander Hamilton is much more respected than Jefferson by many.
We have about 15 minutes left. Don't thank the caller. Invite others. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Saul Cornell. He teaches history at Fordham University, and he is the author of the book, A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. Just to go back to something that you touched on a little bit ago, it seems that a lot of the conversation about Second Amendment and about gun rights, what people are trying to do is they're reaching back, and what they want to do is touch base with the founders, and they want to touch base with the 18th century. And what you've said is that truly it seems that the way that we talk about it now, though, that we talk about the guns and gun regulation and whether we should have it or shouldn't, and our attitudes about guns, this is much more rooted in the 19th century, that particularly we start to see this, I think, in the run-up to the Civil War, than it is in the Revolutionary period. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the most difficult problems you face when you try to analogize to the 18th century is you're dealing with a rural society of small face-to-face communities. As society gets more urban, as society gets more diverse and community breaks down, and as the market revolution starts to flood the market with a variety of goods, including cheap handguns, you're suddenly in a very different situation where some of the informal mechanisms for policing no longer exist. And it's much easier to get a lethal weapon, and one that can be easily concealed. So that's the problem we live with today, and that's a problem that only really emerged in the 19th century. And it's unfortunate that people don't, in the current debate, that we're not having a very sound and calm conversation about, well, there are going to be guns in America. What kind of regulations are more likely to reduce the chances of them getting into the hands of people who shouldn't have them? That would be a very kind of calm policy debate. But instead, the debate is always about, you know, the right to bear arms, and it's always about, you know, runaway government. The reality is, of course, Americans throughout their history and through most of their history have neither been anti-government nor slavishly supportive of government. They've had a fairly, I think, sensible view that government is necessary and you build in the appropriate checks to keep government in check. But, you know, for most periods of American history, we have not been dominated by a kind of libertarian ethos. I mean, the beauty of James Madison and the founder's vision is, you know, in Madison's famous words, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. You have to basically build a clock mechanism where all the gears are in perfect balance. I think, unfortunately, what has happened in modern America is we live in a very sort of anti-federalist age, if you will, where there's just this corrosive paranoia and suspicion and antipathy to government. What we really should be having a conversation is about how to make government effective. You know, and if government is more effective by shrinking parts of government, that's fine. If government is more effective by expanding it, you know, moderately in some areas, that's fine too. But we're not really having that kind of calm, dispassionate. We're tending to have a very sort of ideologically charged culture wars kind of debate, and that's really not helping us very much.
Well, let's talk with someone else in Savoy next, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm going to need 3 or 4 minutes to make my main points here.
That's an awful lot of time on the air, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know that we can give you 3 or 4 minutes, but please go ahead.
You think in the age of PowerPoint you should be able to do it in 3 bullet points.
Yes. Well, compared to the amount of time you guys have used, my 3 minutes or 4 minutes isn't very long. A quick question. Fordham is the one near Lincoln Center, right?
Well, Fordham has 2 campuses, one near the Botanical Gardens and one near the Lincoln Center, yes.
Okay. Now, I think the key thing here is that the general public out there needs to understand that 90-plus percent of people talking about anything like you all doing today is just fancy talk, because most people don't seem to be able to perceive what and retain anything about what life was like 150, 200 years ago. Now, if everybody could kindly remember that Northwestern University is probably called that because Indiana and Illinois were the Great Northwest back in those days, and that Illinois did not join the Union till 1818, and that everybody didn't go into grocery and supermarkets and meat markets to buy meat. They took their guns and went out and killed animals to eat meat. So a gun was a normal part of life. Now, the idea can go back to Lexington and Concord and to the Swamp Fox back in the Carolinas. The idea was to have citizens who, at a drop of a hat, if necessary, would pick up their guns and go help fight off some enemy. Now, oddly enough, the Patriot movie is on television this past weekend, and the Patriot movie has several accurate points, but I am not saying the details of the story are accurate, but the concept that the idea was to keep Cornwallis bottled up as much as possible down in the Carolina country was completely accurate. I know some descendants of the Swamp Fox. His real name was either Francis Mary.
As we, you know, my kids, when they were in elementary school, the teacher was always very good about saying, yes, and do you have a question? So just out of...
No, I have no question. I have comments.
What would your question be?
I have no questions. I have comments. And my comments are that the public needs to understand that the idea was to have citizenry who would come with their guns and do things when needed. That was the basic bottom line. Maybe they did build in well-regulated militia as a way to cope with other possibilities of counter-revolutionaries, etc. But the basic idea was almost everybody had a gun, and that's how they got their meat. And the idea of having volunteer militia people is pretty well represented in the Patriot movie. It's not very politically correct. And that's why that movie, I think, got zero Academy Award nominations, because it's not current.
I mean, I think there's no question that the founders believed in the idea of an armed citizenry, and they believed that, you know, you had both a right and an obligation to bear arms, and that notion is hard to translate to modern Americans, because it requires that you not only think in terms of rights in a very modern government hands-off kind of way, but it also requires you think about rights in a very 18th century way, which is rights are, you know, both politically facilitating, and they're sort of designed to sort of nurture a virtuous citizenry. And those are ideas that are less common today and quite alien to a modern American political culture. So, I mean, I agree. I think it's hard for us to understand these 18th century documents because we don't live in the same kind of society.
Well, this, I guess, this gets at a basic question. And whenever we have a conversation like this where we're trying to both look at a contemporary issue and the way that we talk about it now, and then also try to get some perspective by looking at how people looked at that issue and thought about it at another time. I guess we wonder at the end of the day how getting a better understanding of the Second Amendment and how it's viewed by the people who wrote it, what does that do for us now as we continue to try to wrestle with not only what that Second Amendment means, but also how we deal with the issue of gun ownership in modern America?
Well, I think that the biggest mistake we sometimes make, and it's sort of most evident in some of the debates about originalism, which I think are not very productive, we're trying to understand how a right functioned in a society that is rather different than ours. So we need to approach it in a sophisticated manner. And I think the real insight by doing this is not that we get a kind of clear prescription about what to do, but we gain some wisdom. And I think the wisdom to be gained from this is that if you're going to have a society with a lot of guns, which of course is what we have in America, you need an effective regulatory mechanism in order to ensure that those guns serve socially desirable functions and only minimally impose undesirable social costs. And the great tragedy of the recent debate over gun rights is we don't have people, we don't have any discussion about what that regulatory regime, you know, what those regulations would be, because we're just trapped in this sort of very visceral, emotional language about rights. I mean, now that the Supreme Court has actually expressly affirmed that the Second Amendment is an individual right, one would hope that we can actually have now a more intelligent and calm discussion about how to regulate firearms in a way that minimally intrudes on the rights of legitimate users, but might actually have some significant policy implications for lowering gun violence and other negative attributes from sort of our gun culture.
Right, let's go on and try to talk with somebody else here on a cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good. Just a real quickie here for you. It just seems to me that I don't know the last callers could offer some, I don't know, statistic arguments to this. He seems to be pretty well versed in that. But anyway, it just seems like when a society goes ahead and cannot guarantee an individual's personal safety, you know, we say, oh, don't do anything, wait till the cops get there. And you can't always wait until the authorities arrive to take care of yourself. If society cannot guarantee your safety, why they also cannot, you know, go ahead and impose a rule upon you that would take away from your ability to defend yourself. And, you know, I don't know, that's just too simplistic of an argument.
Well, it's interesting because, for instance, we wouldn't apply the same thing to health care. Like, if society can't guarantee your health care, does that mean you have a right to break into a pharmacy and do whatever's necessary? So, I mean, I don't think the logic of that argument gets us very far because, you know, the way we construct, you know, a civil order is not along the lines of, well, if you can't guarantee this for me, then I get to do this. I mean, we don't make those kinds of, you know, arguments about, you know, I can drive as fast as I want if you can't guarantee that I can get to the appointment on time.
Two entirely different things. Two entirely different things, sir. We're talking about a person's individual survival. And if you
but with healthcare, you're also talking about a person's individual survival as well. So, I mean, the point is, I think that we need to recognize that when we try to regulate something like firearms, the same way when we try to regulate how fast you can drive in your car, what we're always doing is we're saying, here's the calculus we have. If people drove as fast as they want, they could get to where they need to go without, you know, delay. But we would increase the number of automobile fatalities. If we slow people down to a crawl, we would reduce automobile fatalities, but we would see major inconvenience. So what we try to do is we try to have a rational argument about what's the speed limit that produces the most significant decrease in automobile fatalities at the same time that we don't unduly inconvenience people. And I think that's the same argument. I mean, look, you could argue that you need a cruise missile because you never know when an airplane is going to come crashing into your house. I don't think that means you get to have a cruise missile. So none of these arguments are sort of absolute. They're all arguments about balancing a variety of interests. And that's what politics is for. That's why we have a political process, so that we can come up with the best solution so that we maximize the things we want to maximize and we minimize the things we want to minimize. I mean, it's never simple, you know, I get to have this because, you know, you can't guarantee my safety. You know, life has no guarantees, really. So, I mean, I'm not sure we can follow that logic very far.
And we only have maybe about 2 minutes. I have one other caller I want to try to get here. We'll go back to someone here where we are. This is Urbana and line number 1. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to get very specific in response to that last caller. Yes, he has a right to bear an arm to defend himself. Yes, he has that right. Now, everybody doesn't get to keep all their rights if they misuse them. Convicted felons don't get to vote, and freedom of the press is not unlimited also. But He has the right to bear an arm. Why can't we make that safe? That means getting specific numbers which identify an individual gun, just like we have numbers which identify an individual vehicle, to trace it back to who sold it and when and who owns it now for tracing purposes of crime. And that also means trigger locks, just like we have, you know, safety locks on the top of a medicine bottle. Why is this an odd concept that, you know, because you've got the right to bear arms doesn't mean that we don't have a trigger lock to turn the gun on and also the kids can't get to it? Those are really specific things that I just don't understand why the right to bear arms people are so against it. They're only common sense in my mind. I got to go. Thanks, bye.
No, I think those are excellent points. I think nobody is saying that people shouldn't have a right to defend themselves. The question is, what sorts of common sense, reasonable regulations would not only allow people to do that, but would also make everyone else safer? So not only trigger locks and not only serial number on guns, but also, you know, is it really a net enhancement of everyone's safety if you get to buy an unlimited number of pistols when you go to the gun store? Does anyone really need to be able to buy 20 handguns at one shot? You know, maybe there's one or two collectors out there, but for most purposes, if you're buying that many handguns at one time, it's very likely that you're going to flip those and they're going to move into the illegal market. So rather than have a kind of, you know, do I have a right to defend myself or not kind of argument, which really gets you nowhere, I think the kind of discussion that the last caller was suggesting, like what regulations would only minimally intrude on the rights of legitimate gun users but would make us all safer? And that's the conversation we're not having.
All right. And there, well, I'm sorry that we're going to have to stop because there we are at the end of the time. If you'd like to read some more about the history of the Second Amendment, you can look for the book I mentioned a couple times. The title is A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America. It's published by the Oxford University Press by our guest Saul Cornell. He's professor of history at Fordham University. And Professor Cornell, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.